Next case is 99-504, Kelly Cook versus Douglas Risk, M.D. Justice Resnick has recused herself in this case for very pleased to sit in place of Justice Resnick. Judge Michael Payne, who is a judge of the Second Court of Appeals sitting in the Second District, noted that. Judge Payne. Mr. Romanoff.
Counselor, we've read the briefs, we understand the facts and the alternate juror and the deliberations and all that. We ought to get right to the law. And okay. The issue to me is there prejudice?
Your Honor, from the appellant's point of view, that question skips right past the fundamental issue in this case. And the issue is whether or not the trial court abused his discretion in declaring a mistrial.
So once it's tainted, once the bell is rung, you can't unring it.
I think that is true in large part. I do think that for a court to question each specific juror about what happens in the jury room is going a little too far when, in fact, the trial court has declared the trial.
Did either of the parties ask the court to determine by questioning of the jury whether or not the presence, I understand that the mere presence, he was in the jury room, I don't believe from what I read there was any evidence he said anything, but did anyone ask the court to determine whether or not the presence of this other person weighed upon their determination in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did he refuse to do that?
I'm not exactly sure what specifically the trial court said when asked by counsel for defendant to hold the jury and ask them if the presence had an impact, but the court did not question the jurors other than the alternate juror as to what impact the presence of the alternate may have had.
How then is the court able to determine that the verdict, that the parties had been prejudiced by the party being in the courtroom if he didn't ask anybody about that?
If the court is in need of determining the prejudice on a particular issue.
Well, don't you have to show that the parties were prejudiced by the conduct of the jury or the juror?
I think, Your Honor, in this particular case, because the trial court declared this trial, that prejudice need not be examined.
Oh, here. You're going on what the court did. He didn't have to do anything because he did this. But isn't there something that the court has to do before he declares a mistrial? Doesn't he have to question the jurors to determine whether there was in fact prejudice, and then if there was prejudice, he declares a mistrial? Didn't he do something without first determining factors that he had to know about.
Your Honor, in this particular case, the trial court judge was alerted of the fact that the alternate juror was in the deliberation room by the bail office. Then he questioned only the juror that was the alternate juror and determined that the alternate juror was present throughout the deliberation process.
Well, what you're saying then, in the trial court's determination, the presence of another juror in the room was prejudice in and of itself, and he declared a mistrial.
That is exactly what I'm saying. I'm not saying that the trial court specifically said that it's prejudicial in and of itself. I think what the trial court did was recognize the fact that it was a violation of the civil rules. That Civil Rule 47 clearly states that the alternate juror is to be excused when...
And that any further conduct by the trial court was unnecessary because it was, he determined it prejudiced without even discussing it with the jurors.
I think that's a fair assumption to make, Your Honor.
Would it be per se prejudicial for the alternate to have entered the jury room during deliberations to get his hat and coat for a minute?
I don't think that would be per se prejudicial, Your Honor. Primarily because, and there are some cases directly on point. I think there's a case in North Carolina or New Mexico where an alternate juror went in to get a hat and coat out of the jury room and the presumption is that when that occurs, deliberations cease, and the sanctity that the jury has when deliberating was not violated. And suppose
that presumption was overcome. In fact, there was evidence that they continued deliberating for that matter. Would that be per se?
I think at that point it would, Your Honor.
Frequently, by agreement, then alternate to the jury will tell them not to participate in case we lose one of our regular jurors. Certainly, that kind of presumption of prejudice is that of very practical process.
I've seen some cases along those lines. I don't think that I've seen one in the state of Ohio. Decision. I have never been involved in that particular situation, but I think if there's an admonishment from the court to the alternate juror before deliberations begin, that the alternate juror not express in any way, shape, or form any opinions as to any of the matters.
The court did that. Of course, they don't talk about the case to anybody. The juror testified, I just asked that, I didn't say anything. Isn't that enough evidence to overcome?
Again, I keep going back to one of the points. I'm not sure if it does or if it doesn't, but in this particular case, the judge found that there was a violation of one of the civil rules. He had a lengthy discussion with all counsel present. Wherein they had discussed prior instances where...
In that discussion, before the jury came back, there was a discussion of the record. Did either side ask for this from before the jury came back?
Neither side specifically asked for a mistrial.
So both of you decided to gamble, see what the jury did, and pretty much sort of transcripts explicitly agreed that it wasn't a lawful deal.
I think the discussion specifically was that, well, if you win, I'm going to appeal, and if I win...
And if you had won, and your client had gotten a nice big verdict, would you still feel the pressure to do exactly the type of
evidence? I don't think that prejudice would have come into play. I think that the first issue you have to determine is whether I thought the trial court abused his discretion in declaring a mistrial.
Would you be up here defending instead of... Would you be up on the opposite side if you were to go ahead and vote with the side of the gamble and see, and then
just the way they are.
Well, that is the irony in the appeal that was filed by Dr. Rist. I mean, in fact, when the court declared a mistrial, the response of the defense counsel was, okay. And then after he goes back to the office and for 7 days, he files a motion for a new trial, or I'm sorry, a motion to vacate the declaration of mistrial, and then he files an appeal. And I think that's the ironic fact.
When you've done it back to the same, you had a big verdict, and the judge said, oh, mistrial, you would have certainly filed and say, no prejudice?
Well, I think that I would have first examined the argument of whether or not that there was an abuse of discretion. In this case, and I don't think there was. I thought that the trial judge's analysis of the problem, analysis of the violation of the rule, and discussion with counsel clearly set forth that his reasoning in declaring this trial was right on.
It seems to me that I read somewhere that both sides
agreed, stated
or agreed or in some conversation that the verdict would be tainted. Well, is there any indication? Did I read that, or?
Yes, you did read that, Your Honor.
So it was a consensus of both lawyers who were trying the case, saying, "Hey, you know, this verdict, whatever it is, going to be tainted, and something's got to be done." I got the impression that something had to be done, or they agreed that something had to be done.
Is that right? Your Honor, I was there, and the defense attorney, in fact, indicated that he felt it was a tainted verdict.
That's what I thought.
And the trial judge, acting on the discussions of all counsel involved, said, "I have no choice to declare a mistrial," and that's what he did.
Mr. Romanoff, you haven't had much chance to get into your argument. I have to keep you from doing that, too. It seems to me that, well, I voted to bring this case in a review because I thought it gave us an opportunity to decide which rule of law we want to apply in Ohio. As you know from the briefs, we know from the briefs, there are two views on this. One is that it's pretty much a purist view that if there is any invasion of the privacy of the jury while the jury is deliberating, that's prejudicial, presumed prejudicial, and so there's a mistrial. The other seems to be the Ohio rule, which is State v. Ken or Kahn, K-E-H-N, which says you look to see whether there was any prejudice as a result of contact with jurors. To reverse here, I think this is an important case beyond all of the... We have all sorts of cases on abuse of discretion. I mean, we don't need to set a test for that any longer, I don't think. The question, I think, the important question is, which test do we adopt in Ohio? Do we continue to use the 1977 test announced by this court? And the facts here make it a little difficult because the judge, in my view, should have questioned the jurors under the Ohio test. And each juror should have been asked, were you influenced by body language or motions or facial gestures or whatever by a juror who had been discharged? I think it's important to remember this juror was no longer an alternate juror. He was discharged. Isn't that correct?
That's right.
So he's like another citizen.
Right.
He knows a lot about the case, certainly, but he's like another citizen, goes into the jury room and sits there during the entire jury. Well, which rule? You seem to be arguing, I think your case, it seems to me, to rest on the other rule, which said that if someone is permitted to sit in the jury room without the direction of the trial court judge, that's prejudicial, that we have to protect the sanctity and privacy of the jury. And the only way to do that is not to look at each case and ask jurors, but the only way to do that is to make sure that there is not contact with someone outside the jury. There are a lot of cases cited. It seems to me there the way that it looks to me like the majority view in the country seems to be the view that the so-called purist view that if there's contact or invasion of the jury that's a mistrial. What I would assume you would agree with that. Do we need to change Ohio law, do you think, or do we get around Kahn somehow?
Well, I think that you do need to not necessarily change Ohio law, but I think there needs to be some clarification. And going back all the way back to the Farm Letter versus Lieberman decision, where a civil case was involved, the court still assesses where there has been irregularity or misconduct on the part of the jury, which might affect its judgment, or improperly influence the verdict, a new trial should be granted. It clearly appears that no improper effect could arise from the alleged misconduct of the verdict should stand.
Could arise. That's the word there to me. That could arise.
Could arise.
I mean, anything's possible, and we simply don't know, in this case, we certainly don't know what effect the so-called alternate juror had on the jury. We assume none, but we don't know that.
And I think if you take this case and indicate that in a case where an alternate juror is present for the deliberations, and I see my time is
up. Thank you.
I think that the courts should go one step further and says where, however, it clearly appears, I would add, from the record, without invading the privacy of the juror, that no improper effect could arise from alleged misconduct, that the verdict should stand.
Okay, now when you say without invading the privacy of the jury, do you mean that the judge does not question the jurors?
I think other than the juror that's involved in the misconduct, and I think that examination should be done in chambers. I think that going to the jurors who are not involved in the misconduct and questioning them as to what might have happened in the jury room and their thoughts on how they arrived at their verdict is clearly an invasion of the privacy. And I would ask this court to adopt, like you said, what I think is the view in the majority of cases, that we leave deliberations. We give the jurors a certain amount of privacy and leave those deliberations in the jury. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rubinoff. And Mr. Willie.
You may have placed the court.
Mr. Willie. Mr. Willie. I wonder if you could follow up then. You know, given the exchange that counsel had with the Chief Justice and the case that the Court of Appeals cites, the Armletter versus Lieberman, is there some presumption going which way? Here you have a trial court sua sponte declaring a mistrial with no information. Well, the case said, does Armletter actually give us a bit of a sort of a presumption where there is regularity, irregularity in the proceedings, there should be a new trial? And then it goes on to say, unless it can be shown that there was no effect, we'll call it prejudice, or no effect by that irregularity, only then, is that the case? Only then is it an abuse of discretion? Here we have a judge who didn't inquire. So is the irregularity enough to push this? It's not an abuse of discretion because there was an irregularity. Or does a judge have a duty?
The judge has a duty.
But where's that come from?
I think Armletter analyzed the majority authority at the time and concluded that in that majority court at that time would require demonstration of prejudice.
It doesn't sound like that, though. The Court of Appeals, and I haven't read the case, but it says...
The decision itself is very thoughtful and weighing the different facts.
Okay.
Reserving what is otherwise a valid verdict of the jury after perhaps a lengthy trial, and thereby holding the sanctity of jury trial,
okay,
or the confidence in jury trial, as opposed to where an irregularity occurs. And in weighing that, the Armletter Court concluded that it was better to require demonstration of prejudice in order to overturn such a verdict. Since that time, this court in the state of Michigan reaffirmed their vote and continued to place president. Now, Cook and her reply brief have cited numerous decisions from the courts of the state that demonstrate that maybe since 1877, these office authorities had swung against the requirement of presidents. But in 1993, the U.S. Supreme Court decided the Obama case, and in that case, it was not identical to that. It was one whereby in a criminal case, the parties had by agreement permitted two alternates to sit through the deliberation, and afterwards that was asserted as an error under Rule 52B of the federal criminal rule. But in looking at the precise issues in this case, the U.S. Supreme Court first said that the mere presence of an alternate juror did not affect the substantial right. Then went on to conclude that it would require demonstration of prejudice in order to overturn the jury verdict where an alternate had sat through such deliberations. Since 1993, and there are numerous federal courts prior to Alana who also had an assumption of conclusive prejudice whereby such a mishap would require automatically
Counsel, does it make any difference, as in this case, where both sides agree that the verdict is tainted, does it make any difference if they agree to that, or do we just ignore that? It seems to me that the courts, in counseling with both sides, felt there was an irregularity, and they talked to them, and they both said, hey, Judge, I think there's a verdict's going to be tainted, and we agree with you declaring mistrial. Well, does he then have to question the jurors after this to make sure that his determination is right?
Well, come back to your premise. I disagree that both parties agreed that it was tainted. I think everybody questioned.
Well, what happened?
There was confusion. Neither the judge nor the counsel had experienced it before. Neither knew what the law was. Nobody knew how to proceed. As the discussions proceeded, and so on, the record before the court, the counsel for the defendant did suggest to the judge polling the jury and he said, asking them to detail whether the president had any effect on their verdict.
Now, it might have taken, were you there?
No, I was not, Your Honor, but this is all on the record before.
All right. Well, it might have taken that what I've been relying upon to be true was false. That both sides didn't agree that the verdict was tainted?
Yeah, let me explain that. They both questioned it, and defense counsel just suggested polling the jurors. Plaintiff counsel said, no, wait a minute, I'm not sure that that's going to assure us that we've got a good verdict, and defense counsel piped in on tainted, so they were questioning. And they're right, I mean, this is an irregularity. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's an agreement that required a new trial, because what then happened was all counsel agreed, and the court agreed, we'll take the verdict.
Well, if both parties agree to the activities of the trial court, can they then appeal what the trial court does?
No, you misunderstood. They did
no,
not
no.
Agree
to I'm just giving a hypothetical. Let's forget about this case. If both parties in chambers agree with the trial court that something should be done, and then later one of the parties go back and talk to one of the partners, and the partner said, you agreed to what? And then they appeal what they agreed to. Are they able to do that?
I believe, Your Honor, the answer is only under the plain error rule, whereby that the error was so egregious and so important to justice that it required reversal, even if the parties agreed. That was in the Obama Supreme Court case. They agreed to it, and they still reviewed it.
But isn't it clearer than that in this case, Mr. Roy? I mean, to be fair about this, thereupon the following bench conference began. The court, I will read the verdict, and then I will poll the jury. Then I'm going to have to declare a mistrial, Mr. Boddy. Okay.
Yes,
that's your side. Okay. Doesn't say okay, but I object.
No.
Haven't you invited the error that you're now claiming is there?
No, I do not believe so, because if you look back in the entire context, as I was explaining, the first understanding was we'll take the verdict, and everybody agreed Once you know what it is, then whoever loses is going to make their motion. But then the judge brings the jury in, he gets the verdict, he brings counsel up to the bench, and he says, I'm going to pull the jury, and then I'm going to declare a mistrial. Now, I don't know what the counsel is supposed to do. Maybe he should have objected. It certainly is not an agreement to a mistrial. It's contrary to everything he agreed to before. The party that he agreed to before, which was that whoever lost would make their motion. So this was something different, and I don't know whether the defense counsel at that time should have said, I object. The judge made it clear he had made up his mind at that point to declare a mistrial. And I think it was simply an acknowledgement of what the judge was supposed to do rather than an agreement.
It was sua sponte. This wasn't, yes. Nobody moved for
it. Nobody moved for it. It's what he declared after getting the verdict.
I didn't hear your answer to Justice Piper. Why do you say there was no duty to object to the mistrial?
So you can object anything at any time. I mean, if I have to, is open your mouth and say object.
But I don't believe it was necessary, and I think from the entire colloquy between the court and counsel, it was understood that somebody needs to move for mistrial if that's what the law was. And
did your predecessor make any arguments? I understand that what happened is Judge Walker said, this is before the verdict was actually announced. I'm going to let them announce the verdict. We'll poll the jury, and I'm going to be voting with mistrial. But the way it went, that discussion occurred before the verdict was actually announced.
Yes, but he had it in front of the jury in the room, and he had the verdict in his hand at the time.
Was there any argument advanced by your predecessor, either at that time or after the verdict was announced, the judge, I don't think the law requires you to declare a mistrial or any motion to ask the judge to make further inquiry of the jury as to whether or not this interloper in the jury room engaged in any discussion or in any way affected the verdict. Was there any affirmative act undertaken by your predecessor to keep this verdict in place?
Not at that time. Of course, nobody knew other than judge and jurors what the verdict was. He hadn't told them.
Well, once it was announced, did your predecessor stay up? You know when the judge is... he knows what's coming next, because the judge has told him. And did he stay up and say, Your Honor? before you take that ultimate step that you were talking about. That's how they do it.
It's not in
there. Rethink that.
No, Your Honor. All the discussions about what should be done have been had before that point. And the defense counsel has suggested the court pulling the jury and he clearly said the court was just going to give them the affirmative verdict, but ask them whether the presence of the ultimate had been set.
That suggests that judge has already made a decision. It looked like he didn't need to poll the jury because he is going to declare this trial. Probably.
I believe so, Your Honor. And at one point before that, after they agreed to take the verdict and then make their motion, the judge says, before they brought the jury back, the judge says, well, I'm worried. I think we've got a mistrial. And after that, plaintiff's counsel said, well, let's take the verdict and then we'll make our motion. And that would be understood agreement that the judge would take the verdict.
Even after the two attorneys said okay to the judge's intent to declare mistrial, the judge seemed to contemplate and said that you guys can make your motion.
That's right. That
would be the understanding. Mr. Willie, neither of you seems to think it's significant, I guess, that this so-called alternate juror really was not, he is no longer an alternate juror. He's been excused twice from the court. I don't know if this is correct. You're excused, your former colleagues, you're excused because you can wait around if you want to. Why is this not the same as having, other than the fact that he was an alternate juror, he no longer has that status, it seems to me, from the record. How can we justify somebody going into a jury room with no status as a juror any longer, unless maybe I don't know, maybe he can be reinstituted as a juror. I'm not sure
what the rule.
Well, the Obama court again addressed that and said that he wasn't a pure outsider. He had been charged with the duty. He had taken the oath to fulfill his duty as a juror. And when he's discharged, the trial court specifically told him not to discuss this with anybody until the jurors from that.
But he could have left the courthouse and gone to New York.
He could have, he misunderstood, and he went into the jury room. But obviously, he's not a pure stranger.
No, I understand that, but technically he is. Technically, he's like no one else. He has no authority to do anything.
But
am I wrong in that? Could he be recharged as a juror? Say one of the jurors got sick. I mean, judges, nobody got sick or nobody had to go out and smoke, I guess. That's strange language. But the question is, let's assume he's sitting in there and a juror becomes ill and cannot continue to participate in the deliberations. He's been discharged. Can he become a juror again? You know,
be raised from the dead.
I suspect maybe it might would require for the court to hear an agreement of the parties or something to do that. I think it would make sense to preserve what had been, lengthy trials and get to conclusions. But I did want to point out also that the court has looked at other outside influence besides alternates, and if it analyzed that on a presidential basis as well. And require demonstration. Like in our mother itself, a juror, while they were deliberating, went out to the jury room and one of the jurors had contact with an attorney not involved in the case. That was an outside contact, and the court there to analyze in terms of prejudice.
On that issue, Mr. Roy, let's cut right to the quick when we finish. That is, if this jury had come back with a verdict of $100,000 and the court had said mistrial, they'd appealed, and you'd have been here defending the mistrial, wouldn't you?
Yes, that's
correct.
That would be
okay. That was the understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Willie. That was the understanding. Your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Your Honor, if I may briefly conclude, I think the facts of this case demonstrate that the trial judge did not abuse his discretion. He went through a thoughtful analysis of the problems that were encountered in the trial in this matter.
But counsel, wouldn't it be an abuse of discretion? Wouldn't it be unreasonable and arbitrary if the judge indeed had a duty to preserve verdicts and he said, well, these guys both say they want to appeal this. That's enough for me. That essentially in his memorandum, it looked like he said both lawyers said they would challenge this for appellate review or something. He didn't say. But wouldn't that be
is.
If the law is that judges, trial judges should work to preserve verdicts, wouldn't that be an abuse of discretion, either unreasonable and or arbitrary, to just say, gee, they're going to appeal, I don't like that?
Your Honor, my time is up, if I may conclude and answer your question. I do not think that would be an abuse of discretion, primarily because it's an error of the law. It doesn't demonstrate any...
No, I mean, I'm obviously tilting the question in terms of what the law is on preserving verdicts. And, you know, if you take that assumption, if a judge said, just because they're appealing, I don't want to deal with that. And it is an irregularity, no question, everybody would agree, irregularity, does that amount to misconduct?
Even if the law required the judges to do... To make an effort to preserve jurisdiction. And given what transpired in that courtroom, I don't think that there was any evidence of any arbitrary, unreasonable, or unconscionable acts on behalf of the judge.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn.
All right. Hearing. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court. I announce and adjourn.
Thank you.